This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
It is 6 minutes after 10 o'clock. You're still listening to Power Talk with me, Aldrin St-Pierre. So over the next 54 minutes, we are going to be focusing on the rule of law, whether there is a danger of the executive abusing its power, even beyond COVID-19. But very important as well is the violation of people's human rights. So we will be in conversation with Advocate Dalimbofu, Senior Counsel and former EFF Chairperson, and also know that he represented the miners who were shot at Marikana during the Marikana Commission of Inquiry. So what we're trying to do as well is to look into some of the lessons learned from the Marikana massacre. We're also trying to look at some of the findings from the report and what the report tells us about the police, as well as the training of the police, as well as crowd control and also enforcing the law. And then we also have Siseko Khumalo, who you may have heard on the show as well, who's the editor of Journal of Decolonizing Disciplines. And the argument that he is putting forward is around the abuse of executive power, and also where do we look to during this particular period? What is it that the watchdogs, including civil society, are doing to make sure that there is no abuse of power? And what he laments as well is how, when the announcements were made by the president in terms of the rules of engagement, as well as the new regulations that are being implemented, he feels that the rules were just welcomed, and there was no proper interrogation of what it means and what it will mean beyond this particular period. So we also be taking your calls on 0861-987-000. You can tweet at Aldrin St-Pierre, hashtag Power Talk, and also tweet at PowerFM987. As we start this conversation, I just quickly want to read this excerpt from the Marikana Commission of Inquiry's report. It says that the National Planning Commission found that after 1994, there had been a decision to demilitarize the police force. However, there had been remilitarization of the police in recent years. Mr. Hendricks found that there had been remilitarization of the police since the time when he worked with SAPS. He explained what this meant. And he says that on the organizational level, the traditional view of the role and the position of the police in society implies that the police are being managed as an army. This may lead to the characteristics such as army officers and command, military rank and the hierarchy. Military discipline, military training, military culture, and the restriction of rights and liberties of personnel. On the operational level, this traditional view may lead to an operational militarization of the police, defined as performing military duties and or implementing military principles in performing police duties. The implementation of the military principles in the performance of the police duties lead to the use of violence and arms as an appropriate means to solve problems, thinking in terms of, in inverted commas, enemies, resulting in an approach that does not solve problems but only combats systems. These principles are mostly applied and highly visible in public order policing and reactive style of police in interventions performed as firefighters. Advocate Mbofu, good morning and welcome to Power Talk. I'd like you to just quickly comment on that.
Thank you, Adam. No, thank you very much. I think this is a very, very important topic, and I hope you will be carrying it throughout the 21 days in different forms and maybe with different people. Mm. Look, the starting point is this. I think we must not just be blindly critical. We must accept that the government was faced with a crisis. We must accept that the regulations had to be drawn in a hurry and so on. So, they wouldn't be the most perfect regulations. So one of the things that I'm hoping the government is doing is to monitor the situation on the ground so that with a similar speed, amendments can be made where unforeseen circumstances arise. Now, having said that, I think the first mistake that the government made was really to try and declare what they call the state of disaster, which was in real effect a state of emergency, but I think they were, for political reasons, they were shy to call it a state of emergency. So, you know, they must decide whether there's a state of emergency or a so-called state of disaster, firstly. Secondly, you're quite right. From a human rights point of view, the government must understand that there are certain rights, you know, in terms of Section 37 of our Constitution, there are certain rights which cannot be suspended, even in a state of emergency, let alone a state of disaster. Those rights include the right to life, the right to human dignity, the right not to be treated or punished in a cruel, inhuman or degrading way, the right not to be tortured, and so on. There are various rights of children and so on, and rights of arrested persons. Now, if the Constitution says that those rights cannot be suspended, even in a real state of emergency, not one that has been declared indirectly, then it should show you that the constitutional framers knew where we come from as a country, what kind of history we have, and that there are certain things that should always be with us. Now, I've seen about six or seven different kinds of footage which indicate clearly that those lessons of Marikana have not been learned, that you have just gone through now. Which for me, you know, as a human rights lawyer, mean that there has not been proper education or preparation of these people who are roaming our streets with guns. And, I mean, without exaggerating, you can end up with another Marikana, because people will at some stage, we don't know how long this state of disaster or emergency is going to be. And in the long run, if this is not addressed, there will be a revolt, because we know human beings cannot just withstand oppression, you know, for the sake of the greater good. So then once you have a clash anyway, you might have a clash, a small clash in some small place against the police, and then it will spread out. And can you imagine in a time like this, what will then happen? I mean, we'll then have to deal with that disaster and the virus at the same time. So my view is that these rules have not been thought through. The government did not think it through properly. And as I say, it's understandable, because it was in a hurry. But right now is an opportunity. They should consult properly and make sure that necessary adjustments are made. I mean, for example, you can't have regulations that apply equally in the township, in a suburb, and in a rural area. I mean, if you say to people in a rural area, you know, only supermarkets will be open, what do you mean by that? Because, you know, so you must start thinking through.
So it should be a targeted intervention.
Absolutely. Targeted intervention, mostly, you know, localized to a certain extent. Of course, there must be an overall framework, which is the Disaster Management Act or the State of Missions or whatever. But there must be allowance for localization, for realities. I mean, I saw a gentleman who was interviewed on SABC and walking with his little daughter. And the interviewer says, you know, why didn't you leave the daughter behind for social distancing? And the guy says, leave her behind where? You know, in a squatter camp where she might be raped and so on. And we haven't thought of those. Even on the health side, the so-called social distancing, how is it going to happen if you are 10 people in a squatter camp crammed in one room? You know, in one of the footages, the policeman beat up a person for being outside within the yard and saying, Ngenendlini.
Yes, yes.
And then you think, well, that's not what the regulations say. That, you know, why must you be literally inside the house if you are still within, you know. And then, of course, we know that we live in an unequal society and a racist society, and one where the indignity of black people is a norm. So all these things that you have seen, the abuses have been against black people, they've been against poor people. Now imagine what uproar would happen if you had white people being rolled at gunpoint by soldiers and being told to do exercises.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
because of the self-hate that we have and where we come from, and that's where the Marikana issue becomes relevant.
Yeah.
It's easier. You know, black life is cheap. We laugh when we see people being abused by soldiers,
mm-hmm.
but simply because they are poor people and their lives are worth less. Yeah.
Sure. Okay, so we also have Siseko Khumalo, who's the editor of Journal of Decolonizing Disciplines, who's part of the conversation. Siseko, good morning and welcome to Power.
Good morning, Algernon, and thank you for having me.
So one of the points that you also raise in your piece is how, for instance, these rules were wrote up so quickly.
Precisely, and I think for me, Advocate Dellenbaugh, who has already sort of touched on this, to say we do understand and appreciate the circumstance that we were working under, which was to say, and if you look at the timelines, right, and I'm just going to, in terms of systematically think about this, on the 22nd, the president declares this state of disaster, and precisely as Dellenbaugh is suggesting, it was necessarily couched in a language that would be palatable to South Africans to say it was a state of disaster. Gandhi agrees when you were looking at something more of a state of emergency, right? So that happens on the 22nd. We then have the entire executive moving exceptionally quickly and rapidly to institute regulatory mechanisms, to put up and to amend, to make changes to the legislation. And one of the things that was concerning for me was how everybody abdicated from their, I suppose, oversight mechanism. You have the DA leader, Steenhuisen, who welcomed the move by the president and the move by the executive. Where were the checks and balances at that point in time in the system, irrespective of where we are? And I think that that's the problem in many instances with our young democracy in this country, is that we tend to think about the now and not have the vision of saying where to from here, post this particular situation, what does it look like? And if you go back to that particular piece that I shared with you guys, one of the things that we saw, for instance, in the Israeli state, and this is the curious part, it's actually very, very funny. Yuval Noah Harari makes this claim to say that in Israel in 1948, when Israel was sort of waging the war of independence, they even regulated how to make pudding. They were pudding regulations, which were instituted in the 1950s and only were repealed in 2011 in the state of Israel. And I think for me, the caution that I'm trying to raise at this point in time is to say that all of these, quickly instituted mechanisms that we see have the nasty capacity of outlasting us. And I think the prize, our eyes should be on the prize to say post-COVID-19, whatever the hell that looks like, but in terms of post-COVID-19, what does South Africa look like? What does democracy look like post-COVID-19? And how do we ensure that the kind of situation that we've seen already in terms of the loss of life in terms of two civilians in this country, that does not continue to happen? And I must just, on a final matter, I just must make a point to that excerpt that you read earlier, which was to talk to the militarization of the South African police services. And for me, it becomes a very problematic situation where we are creating a pressure cooker, if it were, if we can call it that, because you've got the deployment of the National Defense Forces, which are not trained in policing civilians, by the way. The military are trained for combat. So when the president made that particular move, I was very concerned and continue to be very concerned about the existence or the presence of the military on our streets in this country. And while I appreciate that we do need to exercise caution and try and fight this virus, I am concerned that the military are not trained in civilian policing. Then you have police already being militarized themselves. And I think that the two particular bodies are going to feed off of each other to create a problem. The issue here would be a problem if we were to see South Africans attempting to resist what we're seeing in the situation in the country. And it would be an exceptionally chaotic situation, God forbid.
And to that particular point, Advocate Mbofu, what we have seen is actually some people retaliating. Yesterday, I was alerted to a video where I can't remember which township it was, but there was some tension between the civilians as well as the police. At some point, the residents then retaliated, pelting stones at the police.
Oh, well, you know, I was not even aware of that, but that is scarier than what I thought. I mean, but it's inevitable, Adrian. We know that people will not stand for... I mean, why would people, not resist when they are being made to roll on the ground and are being kicked and all sorts of things and are being made to do strenuous exercises? We don't even know what their state of health is. This is a time bomb ticking. Add to that the fact that people don't know what they are going to eat. There's anxiety. They are already worried about the virus and so on. So the kind of tension that's already in the air, if we are going to ignite it with human rights abuses, then we must know that we have a serious problem. And it's just to agree with what Usisekwe is saying. Remember the militarization that was spoken about in the Marikana situation mm-hmm. was, for example, it related to the rankings. You remember the police
yes.
used to,
yep.
to be called general. I mean, the president still calls Bekele general now. Mm-hmm. So it means that, that message of not militarizing the police has not even sunk through even at that level. Now we're talking about something worse than just titles of general. We're talking about literally militarization by bringing the army to work with the police. Do they even know what is the role of the police in the situation? You remember there was a footage, I think it was in Cape Town, where they were kicking people who are drinking. Mm-hmm. Now, the soldier was kicking the guys who were drinking, and the police were looking on. Now, that should not happen. The police should actually be taking care of policing. And they should be the ones who say to the soldier, no, you can't do that. You can't beat the person up. Or actually, I mean, in an extreme case, actually arrest those people who are doing that. But I don't even think, I think the kind of relationship between them has not been defined as to who's going to do policing as we know it, normal policing, and who's going to do just guard duty and providing the military force, for example, just to be a barrier, for people. All those little details, one mistake in those kinds of things can ignite a catastrophe that is beyond this virus. I can tell you that.
We'll get to the role of the executive in just a minute, just after Power News headlines, but I still want to focus on the police and the role of the police, because what we find here in this article that I quoted earlier on in the Guardian, the Guardian also saying that what they do find across the world, what's happening is that people are being abused, the human rights are being violated. But interestingly, though, is these are all poor people who are being abused, whose rights, human rights, are being violated. And I just quickly want to touch on this particular point, also in the Marikana report, where it says that after Mr. Zokwana had said that the local leaders of the NUM should be able to identify people who could assist and who offered cooperation, Major General Mbembe said, "I cannot go to the mountain. It is not and has never been strategically in my training. How do I disarm somebody with an axe as I have a firearm? It will never work. There is no training in the whole world to be like that."
Yeah, well, maybe Siseko wants to come in first.
Sure. Okay, Siseko, you can go.
I think for me, the challenge here is the fact that post-apartheid, in terms of post-94, we did not envision the kind of South Africa we wanted. We wrote the documents. We've got the constitution, which is a phenomenal one for that matter. But we did not think about how does that translate to the health system, to the education system, because what COVID-19 is showing us right now are the continuing disparities within the system. So when you've got a high-ranking police official, because I do not want to use military title, forgive me, colleagues, when you have high-ranking police officials making those particular claims, it goes to show that the state in South Africa, the state apparatus in South Africa, conceptually did not prepare itself for a transition. We had a transition on paper, but there has not been a transition in terms of general socio-political life in the South African context.
Yeah. Yeah, and to add to that, Elton, we must. You're quite right that there will be abuses even in other countries and so on.
Yeah.
But if we look at South Africa specifically, we must know what we're dealing with. We're dealing with one of the most unequal societies in the world. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with a situation where violence is almost, assimilated as an instant solution to everything. We're dealing with an unhealed society where, violence is against vulnerable groups, and we're dealing with the most racist kind of society. Mm. It's a power keg that is just waiting for somebody to ignite it. And in that connection, therefore, that is why it's understandable and easy, even at a psychological level, for a soldier to abuse a black person in a township. Mm. Than they would react if it was somebody, in the leafy suburbs who was breaking the regulations.
Mm-hmm.
So all those things are going to conspire to create a situation which we will regret if we don't address it. I mean, this is probably, this program of yours is probably, should be done almost on a daily basis.
Mm.
So that people should report abuses. People should, there should be quick troubleshooting and
mm-hmm.
and identification of the bad elements within the police and the army. Otherwise, honestly, the virus will look like a Sunday picnic.
Yeah. Can I just 1 minute each on this particular answer before we go to power news headlines?
Uh-huh.
Does it ever become justifiable to beat up people, to kick them, to humiliate them, to try and enforce rules and regulations? Let's start off with you, Advocate.
No, absolutely no. There is no justification for that. Never will be. That's why I started by referring to Section 37 of the Constitution. Mm.
Is this even when they don't follow the rules?
Whatever. Whether they follow the rules or don't follow the rules, you cannot degrade somebody's human dignity. You can't take their life. You can't treat them in a cruel and inhuman way. You can't torture them.
Mm-hmm.
You can't subject them to medical testing without their consent. You can't abuse children. You can't take away the rights of arrested people. In other words, even if you do arrest them, let's say they break the rules and you arrest them, the way you're going to treat them during the arrest and the detention,
mm-hmm.
it must be within the Constitution. As I say, under any possible circumstances you can imagine, even if there's a whole fire engulfing the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what is meant by non-derogable rights. That's the term used in the Constitution.
Sure.
Those rights are inane and they are fundamental to us, and they cannot be removed under any circumstances.
Okay. Siseko, your take?
I think, Elton, one of the most important things that we need to note, and I'm in complete agreement here with Advocate Mbofu, is that we need to make sure and stress to the public that they are inalienable rights, number one, which we have fought for, and number two, to dispel this myth that is going on at the moment in terms of academic and constitutional law experts as well as legal experts who are coming out and saying that particular rights trump others. The project of the law is to be able to balance these rights and to make sure that under any and every circumstance, the rights that are enshrined in the Constitution are upheld and are necessarily kept and that we adhere to the rule of law. And I think it becomes a bit of an intellectual laziness on our part to say mm-hmm. that there's going to be a particular right that trumps another. I think it's not being.
Okay, it's 10:30. It's time for Power News Headlines. When we come back, we'll be taking your calls on 0861-987-000, your tweets at Aldrin St. Pierre, hashtag Power Talk, and also you can tweet at PowerFM 987.
Aldrin St. Pierre, weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Power 98.7.
And we're in conversation with Advocate Dalim Bofu, Senior Counsel, as well as former EFF Chairperson, and one of the legal minds that represented the miners at the Commission of Inquiry into the Marikana Massacre. We also have Siseko Khumalo, who is the editor of the Journal of Decolonizing Disciplines. We'll be taking your calls now on 0861-987-000. You can also tweet at Aldrin Simpier, hashtag PowerTalk, and also tweet at PowerFM987. Vuyani, good morning.
Good morning, Aldrin. One of the things that we as South Africans fail to do is to listen beyond what we see when these especially the senior officials in the SAPS and the SANDF are speaking. Like listen to the Minister of Police, as rightly said, Advocate Dalim Bofu, that he is being called the general. And that militarization came during his time when he was a national commissioner in the police.
Yeah.
But if you listen to him in every way that he's speaking, he never involves the word service in the SAPS. He always talks about the SAP, the SAP, the South African police, the South African police. That tells you the type of the leadership and the type of orientation that he is embarking on the South African Police Service. And therefore, that automatically cascades down to the operational members. And secondly, because there's no clear outlining here, have you ever heard or seen the Commissioner of Police speaking and outlining the operational aspects on this thing?
No.
It should tell you that there is a hush-hush way of decision-making that was done by the executive without looking into the operational aspects. That is why now you don't hear the Commissioner of Police, but you hear a person who makes himself a Commissioner of Police outlining operational aspects. And therefore, automatically, because people are not have no leaders, they are leaderless, they end up leading themselves emotionally so and incorrectly so, therefore abusing the fundamental rights of individuals. The last thing is the perceptions of black people hearing by the skin. That also does not help, because our own people as Africans, we tend to think that Africans can only listen by the skin. And that is a bad misconception. It must come to an end.
Thank you so much. I love the point that you raise around the police commissioner being absent. He's working. We have seen him with the police commission, with the police minister, but we haven't seen him articulating the rules of engagement. And we have also extended an invitation to the police commissioner, but we were told that he's not available. We've also extended an invitation to the police minister, and we're told that he is in the NCC meeting. Owen, good morning.
How are you, Andre?
Good, good one.
I'm fine. Can I engage your panel there?
Okay.
Especially the leadership there.
Okay.
How are you, leadership?
Okay, how are you?
I've engaged on the issue of security forces. What I've also raised this issue on this show that, you know, sometimes you need information on the people that in the military. The problem here on our security forces, I have been saying this, you know, a military is like a second state. When you have any country that decreases the budget of the military, where you know that in any emergency, you need military to intervene in every situation, is either in nurses, every defense must be capacitated in a way that when the state is not functioning, when the nurses are on strike, you have soldiers who can take over. But here we have a country where every year you decrease the budget of the defense force. On other another note, on the issue of reserve forces, you heard about their calling reserve forces. You have a soldier who has been trained for 2 years. He go and sit at home. After a year, you call him up to go and deploy him in the street. What are you expecting from that soldier of a reserve force? No training for a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Owen, and you work for the military, right?
Yes. What are you expecting from those forces who have been sitting at home for the whole year? You call them up, you come, you go and deploy them on the street within 2 days. There is no plan in our defense. And this thing is we've been raising is deteriorating. You are supposed to those military recruit that you have recruited, when they got contracts, train them, keep them in the military for a meantime, so that in time like this, you know they're updated, you know they're trained. But what are you expecting from the guy that you just go and take at work? You deploy him on the street with the police without any training.
Tinyiko, good morning. Hi, Tinyiko. Okay, Tinyiko, can you hear me?
Yes, I just need... Sure. Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, you can go ahead.
Yes, I just need to inquire about the issue of minimal force, because most of the officials tend to be confronted with a situation that is out of hand. So I just need a definition or the intervention. I mean, how is it implemented in terms of those circumstances?
Okay, then. Thank you so much. Advocate Mbofu, would you like to take that one?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, that's a very important thing. Both the Police Act, at least, I'm sure also the I don't know, but in the Defence Act, but at least in the Police Act, there is an injunction for minimum force. Mm-hmm. And so that's a crucial intervention, because why do you kick somebody, in the street, when you should actually be deterring them? You should be using no force at all. The minimum force in that instance should be zero.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, Elton, one should also look at some of the softer issues. You know, also we must understand that the soldiers themselves, the police, men and women themselves, who are doing a great job by and large, are human beings as well. So they are also operating under tense situations. They are also scared of the coronavirus. We don't know enough about this virus.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you must consider all those factors when you are deploying a force against a civilian population.
Mm-hmm.
There will be people who will provoke them and so on and so on. What kind of measures have been taken to ensure that we don't explode the situation? And the other issue, which I think Siseko touched on, which is very important, is the absence of checks and balances mechanisms. You know, people have used this opportunity to reignite Ramaphoria and clap hands without interrogating these regulations, without looking at the dangers. So the media has been doing that, as you're saying, even some of the opposition, instead of creating the checks and balances, we then have a situation where we say, oh, we're the greatest president in the world, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Until people die, and then it's going to change very quickly.
Yeah.
We should be, as civil society, vigilant and making sure that the constitution is adhered to, not just clapping hands. It's very easy to have a press conference and say and do nice sounding words. But what happens on the ground, which is what we're seeing, is what is going to define it.
Siseko, on the point that was raised by Vuyani, which also goes to, I think, which is quite central to the argument that you make in your piece as well, and it is around the usurp of power, for instance, and how the executive rule with decree and decide what happens and what doesn't happen at a whim. You have, for instance, a police commissioner right now. What is it that the police commissioner is doing, and what is it that the police commissioner should be articulating, and not have that being articulated on behalf of the police commissioner by the police minister?
A politician,
I agree with you completely there, Elton. I think one of the things that I am concerned about, and again, let us not forget the fact that South African democracy is just a quarter of a century old, 26 years. Right. And what we're seeing at the moment, and there are a number of things. I don't want to sound alarmist here, but I am curious as to whether or not this overreach that we're seeing at the moment is in any way. You know, I think it was, when was it, last week or something like that, it was always said, the Churchill quote was coming up quite a lot to say, no crisis should go to waste. And I think that in many instances, in terms of party political systems at the moment, the ANC is having a field day with this particular crisis, and I wonder how this is going to shape, number one, the elections, the local government elections going into next year. How is this shaping our economy? Where is leadership in this country at the moment, and are we going toward a authoritarian kind of style of governance in this country? And it's a fascinating thing, because a number of us, as Advocate Mbofu is suggesting, we're clapping hands. sithanda ukubongela uRamaphosa ukuthi awuvumi uhle umsebenzi akwenzayo. There were so many people that were forcing the president to take decisive action. He has taken decisive action. We have seen 2 civilian deaths as a result of that. Who's going to take the blame at the end of this? And you know, one of the, and again, I don't want to sound alarmist, but Advocate Mpofu suggests that what would happen in the case of a revolt in the South African context, would we have a great president that then faces charges from the International Criminal Court for having presided over a state that massacred its own people? For me, the situation honestly requires systematic and careful thought, which at the moment everybody on every side of the system is not looking at the moment. Because, as I say, last week you had Steenhuisen, the official opposition, the official leader of the opposition, congratulating this thing. There were no checks and balances. This morning there was an article that was released talking to where is Parliament? Why is Parliament so quiet at the moment? The judiciary has been, legal experts, legal practitioners have been saying to the president, this is what we need to do. The president is moving in the right direction. We have suspended every single aspect of checks and balances. And lastly, Eldrin, one of the things that I'd like to mention to you is that let's not forget that for the last decade, there was democratic derision in this country. There were, our democratic institutions, our Chapter 9 institutions were under attack under the Zuma administration. And we cannot dismiss that. And my question is to say, will these checks and balances have the necessary teeth to bite when the Ramaphosa decisions that we are taking all right now and that we are also happy about are coming back to bite us in our behind?
Well, ask your question, then maybe I'll also do the follow-up.
All right. I want to know, do you at all get the sense that those who are part of these mechanisms around checks and balances, that they have been paralyzed or is it self-induced?
Well, it's both. I think the paralysis is because, as we've all acknowledged, that this is an unusual situation. It's an emergency by definition. But what we must not turn it into is political football. I mean, this is a time where we really should just put and not want to take advantage and increase our political fortunes. But that's what this clapping of hands has been about, really. It's been about trying to revive, the fortunes of a fledgling presidency, as it were. And we shouldn't do that. I mean, when the president can sit and listen somebody next to him saying "Skop, skit, and donner,"
But he called it out, though.
Well, he did. He said it's not time. No, but it's more than calling it out. Action should be taken. I mean, it should not be an indirect thing where we have to put two and two together and say, okay, well, the president said this 5 minutes later. It's a serious thing. Skop, skit, and donner. You know what that means. If that is going to be in anybody's mind, let alone lips, in this time, then we're in for a high jump.
Okay.
We really can't emphasize this enough. It's just one little spark that will give us a Marikana or something much, much more than that. Yeah. And we don't have to say, oh, well, we told you so, and again, politique around it. Let's prevent such a thing even happening.
Yeah. Okay, so 0861-987-000, we are taking your calls, your tweets at Eldrin St. Pierre, hashtag Power Talking. You can also tweet at PowerFM987. Prince Sonono says that both your guest, Dali, as well as Siseko, are unfair to government, especially during this pandemic. Mistakes like accidents are bound to happen. Why aren't they urging citizens to adhere to the regulations? Also, instead of focusing whether the army deployment is right or wrong, Xoliseka says that there are two groups. One, those who are outside to provoke the police, and two, those with valid reasons. In whichever case, I thought arrest would be the best punishment, but the abuse I've seen is disgusting. Black men has no dignity in the government. Also, Chronicle of the Unknown says that the Minister of Defence said clearly that the reserve forces are people who are in military bases but not yet deployed. They are not on the ground as yet. She never said anything about people who are at home. And a tweet from Freddie, who says that in reality, we are a country currently operating without a plan. Everything is makeshift, e.g. copy and paste, as is what Italy or China did. Then later it's a series of Eisan Gonje. Hence, the constant revisions of the regulations as well as the pronouncements. Advocate Mandula, good morning.
Mofrika, Aldrin, and to the colleagues there, I think they are coming out clear, Aldrin, that when I look at the regulations in PO, it took 72 hours. Remember that when the president spoke on the 15th,
yeah,
it took only on the 18th. And when you look at the Section 3 around it, which I do agree with the colleagues, it is using a Western paradigm of criminal act, you know, procedure act, you know. And for me, when you look at regulations, another missing part, we have people having funerals who cannot travel from one province to the other.
Mm-hmm.
Regulations were silent on it. The second aspect is what Dali was saying.
Sorry, Advocate, on that particular point, don't you think that case law would trump everything
law,
else now, considering that what
I had
ruling
a problem with that white judgment. I had a problem with him that there was no analysis. There was paralysis of analysis, actually, from his judgment.
Mm.
That there were already the issues of culture were not taken into account. And I do agree with Dali that there might be the cushion of language. Gaborone is using the state of emergency language. They are not using the issue of national act in terms of reducing this risk.
Mm.
But I think the final point in Pew, again, which I mean, Aldrin, which I find very sketchy, the role of the state security. I think one aspect that we are missing is that how can they not detect the movement of the so-called carriers of the virus in the national key points? You know, these regulations, as it was said, you don't rush or hurry to draft them without proper consultation and look at the human and people's rights confinement. Because, yes, we are in this crisis, but was it not somewhere how early January not being seen, you know, Aldrin, because there was a sign, there was an indication.
So
I am saying that regulations as well, you can even write them in various languages, but as long as the people on the ground don't understand them, it's what Dali is saying, there will be revolt, rebellion, and unrest.
Dr. Baloyi was even arguing the other day, saying that what government should do is try to get the buy-in of the people as well. Itu, good morning. Itu?
Hi, Aldrin. How's it been?
Good.
Aldrin, I'm Itu Buchele from Harankua. You know, Aldrin, I'm a former member of the South African Police Services. And when the president announced that there's going to be a lockdown, part of the things that I did on the social media was to urge our people to support the government, you know, and to pray for the police, to pray for all who will be on the front line, the soldiers and the nurses. But no, equally so, to come and see this kind of videos that we see now on our social media, it leaves me very devastated, Aldrin. We can't have soldiers and police officers doing this to our people, no matter how wrong they are, but there would be measures and other alternatives, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a video where a soldier is kicking this person and just slapping on him all over, you know. And I truly believe people like Dalimbofu and the lawyers for human rights, but they must take on these cases.
Mm-hmm.
They must take on these cases because we can't, when we have a big problem like coronavirus, you know, killing our people, then we get now our police officers and the soldiers doing this to our people.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that stage has passed, you know.
Yeah.
So we really need to do something about this. I'm truly hurt about this, you know, Adrian.
Thank you so much for your call. Katleho, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Adrian?
Good, good.
All right, man. Point number one, the thing that the gentlemen have got, they are not addressing is compliance. I haven't heard them talking about encouraging the people to comply with what was said by the president. They are omitting that thing. All what they're doing is attacking what is being done wrong by the soldiers and the police, which I also don't support. Point number one.
Okay.
Okay, they should encourage the people to comply as well, because if our people comply, the police and the military won't have anybody to abuse in the street, because the rules say stay at home. Only leave when you're going to buy food. What, everybody knows the rules. I don't have to say that. And then point number two, action on the military and the police is only going to be taken after the operation. They're already accusing the president of not taking action now. Look, people still have to be identified who did this, when, and then he's going to take action after that. So I think it's unfair to say the president doing nothing at the moment while the operation is still going on. But if you look in the deployment of the military, the people wearing red berets, they're called military police.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people that hold the military accountable.
Yeah.
They're like their police who arrest them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's going to be very easy for them to identify them. They know who was deployed where and which military police guy was there.
So the issue then is that in the meantime, what? Do you allow them to do what they do, continue violating people's rights up until after this period and then only hold them accountable then? So the person... just a quick one, Katleho. So there are videos... Katleho, just a quick one. There are videos doing the rounds, and you just heard from Itu as well, where you find military officers kicking civilians. So wait, let me finish. So you have this video, you can see this person, you can see who the soldier is. Has that soldier been arrested? Have you heard of a soldier who has been arrested or been suspended during this period?
Most of the things that happen in the military is held at military level.
The question is, have you heard of a officer who has been arrested, a soldier who has been arrested during this period?
I won't speak on behalf of the military police, but definitely...
The question is, I repeat again, have you heard of a military officer who has been arrested?
No, I haven't yet.
Heard of it? Yes.
But I think we should hold our horses. I think at the end of this operation, there will be people arrested. You're the county, but that's what I'm trying to say.
Okay, Advocate Mbofu?
Yeah, well, I think that's an unfortunate... if he was the person who had been abused, would he say, let's hold our horses for 21 days, or should action be taken immediately? Okay, look, I think that there's a misunderstanding of what we're saying. I mean, Umtung said it very clearly. He used the word balance. All we're talking about is a balance. Nobody is saying the president is doing nothing. Nobody is saying people should not comply. Of course, the president is doing something under difficult circumstances. Of course, people must comply. But we're not talking about the people who are complying. We're talking about the people who are not complying. Otherwise, we shouldn't have a police force. We should just say, let's just tell people to comply. They must not rob. They must not... it doesn't work like that. You must accept that there will be people who will not comply. There will be people who will break the law, just as it happens even under normal circumstances. Mm-hmm. The question is, how should those people be treated? Yeah, bad as they are, they must pay for what their sins, we must condemn them, blah, blah, blah. But the constitution means, how should they be treated? Should they then be beaten up because they have...
Actually,
not complied?
A question here from Masiho then says that, can you ask the gentleman there, especially Advocate Dalimbovo, what must soldiers then do when people are not complying?
Okay, good. That's a better question. What should happen is that's why I was talking about demarcation between policing and barricading and all that. That must first be defined. Secondly, these soldiers must themselves be trained on an ongoing basis. We know it's an emergency. There must be constant training of how to handle the situations and learning. After a day, there should be debriefing to say, okay, we had some people who were throwing stones at us. Okay, we had people who were buying or drinking and so on. What do we do? How do we differentiate between someone who's justifying or someone who really has to go out and look for food, for example? You know, so there must be that. But last resort, obviously, there will always be people who break the law. And no one can encourage that. Then those people should be arrested. And even after they've been arrested, the way that they get treated in the cells. I mean, for example, you can't say people must then be put in mass cells because then they're going to be infected with the virus. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we should be thinking, constantly thinking about a humane way of treating people. Because you know what? We're not saying there must be unrest. We're not calling for unrest. We're just giving a warning. Mm. Number two, the other point that Umtunga has made, which is that, you know, the reason why we have a constitution is to curb executive power. So we don't want a situation where we're going to get used to this shortcut of just kicking people around. Even after the virus is gone, we'll think, the easiest way is just to just go and kick people and make them roll on the floor to prevent them from doing the wrong thing.
Yeah. Okay, Siseko, your take on it. And just quickly, I'd love you to touch on one of the points that you raise in the piece as well. And this is in relation to what one of the callers, I think it was Diniko, who spoke about state security, where state security, what is state security doing? And one of the references that you are making here is the surveillance of the surveillance of the citizenry, which continued, and was it Israel that continued in Israel even post the crisis?
Precisely. So, thanks, Eldrin. So I'll start on the surveillance matter. One of the concerns that I have and that I have had and will, I think, continue to have over the time frame of this lockdown is the fact that South Africans looked forward to this lockdown, right? And in many instances, when you think about political theory circles or political science circles, and I make this in the, what is it, in that particular piece as well, is that the kinds of situation that we were calling for as South Africans is a situation that we only see with the Israeli occupation of Palestine, where you've got military checkpoints, where you've got the restriction of movement, and you've got the surveillance of the citizenry. Now, Yuval Noah Harari makes this claim of this, what he calls under the skin surveillance, right, where we are checking consistently our body temperatures, where we are being surveilled, where we are being watched. The president on the set, he has announced that he has this 10,000-person testing campaign that he will do, which will, of course, start in terms of the Gauteng province. And while I am in agreement with that, while I am in complete agreement with that, I am also cautious about that. I, as an individual who studies political theory and who studies political science, I am continuously cautious around the overreach of executive authority, whether it be in the best benefit of the citizenry or the polis. And this is the reason why you have the legal fraternity there, what is it, in this whole entire equation called democracy, because the legal, the judiciary is supposed to check and balance and, in fact, curtail the overreach of executive power, which is also why you have the third leg of government, which is the legislation, which takes the time to deliberate on issues. And at the moment, what we are seeing is that things are being pushed through. We are being, and just recently, Ustela and Dabeli Abrahams announced the use of our telephones to track people that we have been in contact with in terms of geopolitical location or geolocation rather. And that for me is concerning, Eldrin. These are things that don't happen under normal circumstances and would never fly. South Africans would never approve of such encroachment into our lives, into our privacy, into our civil liberties. And this is something that we at the moment are forgetting. And I understand that we are under some very, very curious conditions. And one of, I think for me, the end game here is not to say that I'm criticizing the president blindly and that I am critiquing, but I also should stress that as a political philosopher, it is my role to critique power. But what I'm looking for are reassurances, not only to myself, but to the polis, and globally, not only in terms of Ramaphosa. I'm talking about Trump here. I'm talking about Putin in, what is it, in Russia. I'm talking about Netanyahu in Israel. We are looking, as a global citizen, we are looking for assurances from our governments that post this pandemic, there will be these particular regulations that are being instituted now will be repealed because we want our freedoms. We have fought so hard for our freedoms only to have them given up and compromised by governments that are overreaching right now.
Thank you so much, Siseko Khumalo, the editor of Journal of Decolonizing Disciplines, as well as Advocate Dalimpofu, Senior Counsel, as well as former chairperson of the Economic Freedom Fighters. It is 11 o'clock. We've come to the end of this conversation. When we come back, we'll be speaking to one of the repatriates from Wuhan.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.